clerical duties.
Is the health training part of their required education for cosmetology?
Your Honor, I think that's a specious sort of argument. And the reason is because, yes, sanitation is tested on the cosmetology exam. They put to work doing endless hours of laundry, sweeping, cleaning mirrors, cleaning sinks. That is not sanitation training for a cosmetologist. That's stuff that these folks do. But coming in, they certainly didn't need to pay $20,000 to go and learn.
The test under Walling is what?
The test under Walling is whether there's an immediate advantage to the alleged employer. Here, their clue was, to be honest, that there was an immediate advantage.
The so-called, what you call employees here, are in a school. At the end of the school, they received a certificate that entitles them to practice cosmetology. For that, in California, isn't that right?
So
now that certificate, it wouldn't be.
They need a certificate. So the question is, does that give license to this corporation without limits to utilize these people as an unpaid labor force to generate profit?
What you're arguing is if they get they're getting no benefit out of this, and they wind up qualified to practice a profession, and they are required to do at least a portion of the duties that you are required to do.
Your Honor, I'm not saying they didn't know anything about it. Well, although I think the court should have taken judicial notice of the Department of Education letters, which certainly suggests they did get no benefit out of it. However, and there's, as a matter of fact, there's evidence of record that they got no benefit out of it since.
Out of what?
Out of going there at all and spending all this money going deeply in debt because they weren't trained adequately on skills such that several of the named plaintiffs were not ever able to even practice in this profession. They wound up going back to being servers at restaurants as they had been before they incurred this massive debt. But, Your Honor, even if we assume, yes, they got the benefit out of it, getting the benefit out of it is not the test. Or, as the Second Circuit case called, an appreciable benefit. That's not the test either. The test is whether the company received an immediate benefit from the work that they were doing. And in Walling, you had these railroad trainees who, where the company was receiving no immediate benefit from their work. In fact, they were impeding and retarding the work of the company, which because it had to have people constantly supervising these employees. That's the opposite of the situation that we have here. What we have here is, for example, as one of the declarants testified, 25 to 40% of the time there was no instructor at all in the salon. Another declarant testified he went 9 months with no instructor whatsoever. When they did any feedback,
they're talking about when they're doing this.
When they're in the salon,
doing customers.
Yes, sir. Doing services for the company's profit. That half the time, they all testified with fairly, with a lot of specificity about the fact that there was frequently no supervisor at all, and that even when there was a supervisor, that they would get no actual feedback, that a lot of times all they would do is report what services they had completed. And the company's witnesses did not dispute this lack of supervision. They disputed it in the sense that they said, sure, there was supervision at the required level of the state, but what that meant was you needed to have one instructor for 25 students anywhere on campus. The instructor could have been in the classroom while people on the salon floor had no supervision of any kind. That's in the record on multiple places, in excerpts of record 946, in excerpts of record 968 through 986 through 989, the 36 deponent acknowledged that the education program is not set up to have one-to-one continual contact with students. That's the kind of supervision, Your Honors, that is required at a vocational school if they're going to be putting people to work, because at that point, as in Walling, they're not providing a benefit, they're actually training on operations. Here, that's not what we see. They're not getting that kind of supervision. And they're doing.
Okay, this is a highly regulated. Here's what's troubling me. This is a highly regulated profession. They have to be bought school is not operating properly. This would appear to be something that the state regulation should take care of. I'm having a little trouble seeing why, if the school isn't doing a very good job, we should say that these people are actually employees under the FLSA.
Right. Well, this
is any authority.
Okay. There are the state regulations governed, first of all, as you know, again, the Department of Education letters, they're no longer operating because their ability to collect student loan money, which is their main source of money, was pulled because they weren't operating in a lawful manner. But those state regulations, the cosmetology regulations, do not decide the issue of who's an employee or not. They're not looking at that test. They're not looking at, for example, in California.
According to that, it basically said that because of what Judge Schroeder just stated, that the real benefit here was to the students because they needed the hours and they couldn't get licensed without serving in some capacity to get this kind of exemption.
Your Honor, the District Court erred on a number of levels. The District Court threw out a lot of our core evidence erroneously by requiring as a part of a Rule 26 disclosure that we disclose to the defendant in opposing summary judgment each unnamed class member that we might use in opposing summary judgment.
What was the big burden about providing three names and addresses of plaintiffs that you were going to obtain declarations from in support of the summary
judgment? That's not the standard, Your Honor.
What's the burden?
There's a tremendous burden.
Don't tell me what the standard is. Tell me how you were burdened.
I was burdened, Your Honor.
By complying with the rule.
It's not complying with the rule. There's no such thing.
And it does comply with the rule. The rule is what the standard is.
Yes, Your Honor, I have. And Rule 26, by numerous cases.
Why didn't you obtain it?
Because that is not required under the rules, Your Honor. There's numerous district court decisions which have held that under Rule 26, in a class case, you don't have to disclose back to the defendant the names of your class members.
Your response was, it's every member of the class, and this punitive class is how many hundreds, thousands of people. You get some, the employee, the defendant has to guess which ones are likely to be.
Not so, Your Honor. The witness is an issue, and the declarants in particular went to the same schools at the same times the plaintiffs. The list was quite small. It was under 100 people.
So why couldn't you name three?
That's one product, Your Honor. So
the fourth product.
Absolutely.
The identity of a witness that you're going to call
a product. No.
I read your disclosure to not be as evident as you say it says. Other current and former student employees of Rebel Schools in India.
Yes, sir.
If I think about a whole sea of people that could come within that definition and aren't just in your school.
We named. Okay. We named one of the clients explicitly in our discovery responses, not in the Rule 26
system. What I'm saying is that the reason these rules were promulgated was because employers could go off and look at everybody in the country that was ever a former student of a Rebel school. Or if you look at the ones you say they should contact, you may have to contact information and bother you say what kind of information they have as part of your disclosure. But if you just categorically say everybody that was former or current student of the Rebel School of Beauty and had worn one, I would go to them and file a different form. And so it seems to me that you have a burden if you want to keep going to narrow that to some extent as opposed to just say, I've got work products, I'll retain any of those people, but they know or their addresses or their names. You have to find it yourself, and there's something by surprise when we end up filing a motion to
suspend. Your Honor, in our briefing, we discussed the Campbell versus Best Buy case, the
Navarro versus Best Buy case. I'm talking about this case. If I was in the first court, if I was a district judge, just like this judge, it would be ridiculous to say you can say all current and former employees and not be any more specific. Well, I don't know what
I would do. We were more specific, Your Honor, because quite a few people, all the people that they actually, our plaintiffs actually knew by name. We listed, includes one of the declarants, another declarant we listed by first name only. That was
in response to the interrogatory.
That was in response to the interrogatory, Your Honor. And so they had this information. So if Your Honors are not persuaded that in a class action, it is not our responsibility before opposing summary judgment to tell a defendant each class member we plan to use to oppose a summary judgment motion, then I would ask you to look, Your Honor, at Rule 37, Your Honors, because the question here in striking our core evidence should be, what surprise, were defendants surprised that we were using class members who went to school at the same time in the same locations as the plaintiffs? But more to the point, how were they prejudiced? Why couldn't they, under Rule 56D, ask for the opportunity to oppose those people? It certainly prejudices us in the balancing. Absolutely, it would be an abuse of discretion, Your Honor, for the same reason that this court just found in the Solid 21 versus Hudlock case, 685, Fed Appendix 530. Because when you have evidence that goes to the heart of the plaintiff's case, where you're excluding declarations and putting a substantial hurdle in our way of trying to oppose a summary judgment, where on the other hand, all defendants would have had to do if they really needed that testimony and had been unable to get it, which we dispute, is to say under Rule 56D, we need to depose those people. And it doesn't push. There's no trial. It's, you know, 2 weeks away. We don't have a jury sitting in. It said we had stipulated to motion filing back and forth dates early because we wanted to get to the core legal issue early. But if they wanted more depositions, they felt they needed them, they certainly could have asked for them and didn't. And I don't think. Yes, sir.
In respect to the solemn day and we were sitting here today and to those who may know from the one of these hurricanes, I didn't be too dramatic in discussing the issue before the court today. But if you take the appellant's argument to its logical conclusion, it would be the doom of all vocational schools. It would be the end because they couldn't operate. And as it is agreed, we start with Portland Terminal. And Portland Terminal is both the place to start, and interestingly, it's the place to end. Because in Portland Terminal, they carved out an exception for vocational schools. Right in the opinion, said that had trainee brakemen taking courses in railroading at a vocational school, it could not be reasonably suggested that they were employees of the school within the meaning of the Act. We have to look at this in the educational context. They understood they were pressured enough to recognize that in the educational context, this is completely different when you're talking about students. And my client is a vocational school. He's teaching students to become practicing cosmetologists. Part of that training and part of the curriculum is that they have to operate in a clinic environment. That clinic environment includes sweeping, emptying trash cans, cleaning sinks, sanitizing equipment. But that's all required on the exam for which they receive certification to operate as a licensed cosmetologist. It's required by the state. They need to have this practical training.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
With respect to these declarations that were stricken, if we were to say that the district courts have stricken them, is there anything critical in those declarations that would make the case?
Absolutely not. You're incorrect, Your Honor. Let's remember, this is not a class action. It's limited to these three specific plaintiffs. Their experience is what is important here. And the fact is, if you read the declarations, which are in the record, all they do is shadow the declarations that were submitted by the plaintiffs in the underlying case before the district court. They added nothing to them. Absolutely nothing. The court even said, although some detail was provided, albeit not a lot of detail, about efforts by the school to subordinate the educational function of the clinics to the goal of making money, it wasn't sufficient. Even if you consider these declarations, it would not change the outcome of the ruling by the district court, which is what it
is. Are there any of these cases pending in state courts?
Well, you just had, interestingly, what just happened, and we had the Second Circuit in Gladwin, and we have the 11th Circuit in Shipman, who have ruled that intern training, interns in a practical training program cannot be considered employees under the FLSA. But we have even a better case that just came down in Collins, which was submitted to the court as supplemental authority. And that involved cosmetology students. It specifically decided that based on following Glad and following Washington, that the economic reality of the relationship between the students working in a clinic, exactly the same thing that we have here, was clearly a situation where the student was the primary beneficiary of that relationship. And that was sufficient to carry the day.
And that was the Seventh Circuit.
That was the Seventh Circuit.
So that's why my question was, are there any cases pending in the California and Nevada state courts that your own position? Because there are state law claims.
I understand that.
These cases are principally under the FLSA.
Correct. I can address the state law issue if you'd like me to.
I'd like to hear your views on whether or not the state law issue is still needed. Is it going to certify the question to the governors?
I don't believe it's necessary, Your Honor. I don't think Martinez is really applicable in this situation. That was a employer independent contractor situation. It's completely different than what we have here, where you have a student in a school. Determining whether someone is an employee or independent contractor, they relied on the control test. And in a student school environment, there's always control over the student, but that doesn't turn them into an employer. And that's why I don't think Martinez is applicable.
Nothing in Martinez that would suggest that the California Supreme Court would come out any differently.
I do not believe it at all. I think
it's an answer to the district court.
Yes, it is completely distinguishable. If you're in the district court, went to pains actually to distinguish it. And they made the point that it makes no sense to extend the employee independent contractor test to the educational context. Schools typically exercise significant control over their students, but that doesn't mean schools are typically employers of its students. That's the analysis that has to be made, and that's why Martinez doesn't apply. That's why I don't believe it's an issue which is critical to the court's determination. If the court would like me to address the Rule 26 disclosure, I don't have
any more.
Your Honor, first of all, on the California law issue, the district court and counsel just now erred in the argument calling Martinez a case about independent employer versus independent contractor. It's not a case about independent contractor at all. I think obviously we want a total reversal, it doesn't seem like you're going that way, then I think that question should be certified because the court misapplied California law, finding that it comes from federal law. Correct.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it sets the standard of who is an employer in California, and this new case that we just provided you shows the California Court of Appeal is using Martinez to determine whether trainees are employees. Martinez did not have to do with trainees. It had to do with who was an employer.
Right.
And it has been the authority in defining who is an employer in California. And the test includes not only control, but sufferable permit to work. And
care these people who are suffered and permitted to do extensive work for the profit of Marinello. I note also on California law that the DLSC opinion letter that you did allow does not pursue, as this district court decided to do, a primary beneficiary analysis under GLAD. It adopts the Department of Labor's six-part test and follows it assiduously, in including going through whether the employer, alleged employer, is an immediate beneficiary, the level of supervision that the people receive. Those are the same factors that we're asking you to look at. So even if you only look at that one letter, it supports our claims here.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted.